He's going, all right, let's get into it. Well, my name is Ross, and I live in L.A. Probably not the L.A. you're thinking of. That's what we call Lake Ann. How many people here have been to Lake Ann, Michigan? Hey, wow, not bad. I was in a presentation a couple weeks ago, and not one person. Nobody even heard of Lake Ann. It's like, okay, well, you got to hold up the hand. Okay, we're in the pinky now. So Lake Ann is a very small village located in the northeast corner of Benzie County. Now, to give you an idea how rural this is, all right, so we got some Benzie County people there. All right. To give you an idea, we got one McDonald's in the entire county. None of this fancy food like Taco Bell or Wendy's or anything. There's one McDonald's in the entire county. So it has a year-round population of about 18,000 people, very rural area. Close to Sleeping Bear Dune, which is that little light-colored spot right there. Here's the Manitou Islands. Here's Beaver Island. We're going to talk a little bit about Skilligalee Island and the Skilligalee Light, which is right about there, which is in a very remote spot, too. And we're also going to talk about a shipwreck named the Westmoreland, which is somewhere in this area. A little bit about myself. I'm a librarian at the Elmira Township Library in beautiful downtown Lake Ann. I'm also a volunteer diver on the Benzie Area Public Safety Dive Team, and we work in conjunction with the Benzie County Sheriff's Department doing operations for them. But I'm a shipwreck guy. Absolutely love shipwrecks. This shipwreck picture was taken by a friend of mine, Cal Coltrati. He's an artist in Milwaukee. Cal also did the artwork for both my book covers, and he's also a tremendous underwater photographer. Now, this picture was taken in Lake Michigan in 2014. The name of the ship is the Rouse Simmons, but you probably know it better as the Christmas Tree Ship. And it rests in 165 feet of water over on the Wisconsin side. But if you look closely, you can see the transom way back here. That's over 100-foot visibility in Lake Michigan. So that's ambient light at 165 feet. Lake Michigan at times can rival the Caribbean for clarity. Well, there's a reason for this. See all this stuff covering the wreck, all that? Those are called quagga mussels. Quagga mussels now represent over 90% of the mussels on the bottom of Lake Michigan and Lake Huron and Lake Erie. Now, the scary part is, if we look off here, we see these light-colored patches. That sand, the entire bottom of the lake is blanketed with quagga mussels, 1 to 5 inches deep. So they do a great job of cleaning the water. So the good news is we get this wonderful clarity. The bad news is, imagine the food that takes away for the small fish and, of course, the large fish that feed on the small fish. So times are changing, and we don't know the long-term effect on the wrecks, but now at least we can see them very clearly, though we do lose a lot of detail when these quaggas cover everything. It's been a busy year for Great Lakes shipwrecks. How many people heard about the rediscovery of the Griffin? I don't know how you want to say that. A few people here. So Griffin is LaSalle's ship. It's the holy grail of Great Lakes shipwrecks. It's considered the first shipwreck on the Great Lakes, though us shipwreck nerds know it's actually the second, the Frontenac's first. But the Griffin was the first sail away. Somewhere in northern Lake Michigan, LaSalle left his boat. The Griffin sailed away with a cargo of furs and disappeared. Well, a couple of gentlemen have claimed to have found it in northern Michigan this spring. And a couple years before that, another gentleman from Charlevoix claimed to find it. And here is what he found on the bottom. Now, he claims it's the bowsprit of the Griffin. They even recovered it and had a CT scan done on it, all with inconclusive results. And these gentlemen found a wreck off Frankfort, Michigan. The state archaeologist came out to dive it. He said it was his 17th Griffin discovery dive, whatever that means. But he dropped down on it and said, nope, it's a burned-out tugboat. Kind of ended the story. So the Griffin is still out there, allegedly. It still remains elusive. The Alice E. Wilds was found this spring. It was a steam barge that foundered off Milwaukee in 1892. It was discovered by technical diver Yitka Hanikova in about 300 plus feet of water. They went down and took photographs of it. Beautiful wreck, beautiful condition. My old group, the MSRA, the Michigan Shipwreck Research Association out of Holland, Michigan, found the John V. Moran. Are there any divers in the audience? All right, so in the Straits, there's a wreck called the Eber Ward. This is the exact sister ship of the Eber Ward, but it sank off Muskegon, Michigan in 1899, and it sank so slowly that all these cabins are still intact, including glass in the windows. So this is probably one of the most intact shipwrecks in the world, just discovered this summer in Lake Michigan. 1899, in February of 1899, very cold year. So what's interesting about these cabins is they're a very light construction. They're almost built like you'd build a house, 2x4 construction, paneling, things like that. And when these ships go down, they usually blow off or float off. So it's extremely rare to find these old wooden cabins intact. Matter of fact, that's why I think it's probably one of the most intact shipwrecks from the 1800s in the planet. So it'll be interesting to see when they get more video of the shipwreck.
Because it went down so slowly, does that increase the chance for survival?
Everybody survived. As a matter of fact, they knew it was sinking, and a car ferry came alongside, and they unloaded in the middle of the night. It was a February cold, like, you know, -6 degrees, -10 degrees out, and they put the gangplanks down, and they emptied all, everything out of one ship and put it in the other, and they all steamed off and left the ship out on the water. It eventually disappeared, so everybody kind of figured it sank. Ah, the SS Hydrus. This was just announced. This was just announced in the news last week, I believe, from a gentleman just down the road, Dave Trotter from Canton, Michigan. So it's a large ship, 410 feet long. I think one of the largest shipwrecks still left in American waters. Sank in the Great Storm of 1913 and is in remarkable shape. I didn't get a chance to ask him yet how deep it is. It didn't look very deep to me, but we'll find out if it's in technical range or recreational range. But excellent shipwreck find by Dave Trotter, and there was an article in the Free Press in the USA Today about it also, if you get a chance to see that. And unfortunately, we lost Dennis Hale. Dennis was a lone survivor of the 1966 sinking of the Daniel J. Morrell off the Thumb. Wonderful man, an author. His book out there, Soul Survivor, is wonderful if you get a chance to read it. He passed away a couple months ago and was sadly be missed by all. Well, a little bit about me. I'm probably best known for discovering the shipwreck of the Westmoreland. And what makes the Westmoreland interesting is it was supposed to be carrying $10,000 in gold pieces and 280 barrels of whiskey in its hold. So I have a little video here. I've only played this a few times in public, but it's a little documentary video that will kind of explain the Westmoreland story. On December 7, 1854, the 200-foot-long wooden passenger steamer Westmoreland foundered during a winter gale in northern Lake Michigan, taking 17 of her crew and passengers with her. 17 of her crew and passengers survived, however, and stories soon began circulating. The Westmoreland carried $10,000 in gold coins in her safe and 280 barrels of whiskey in her hold. 2 decades after the Westmoreland foundered, her first mate, Paul Pelkey, returned to search for the ship and her treasures. In 1872 and 1874, newspaper articles claimed the Westmoreland was discovered and salvaged, her engine and boilers delivered to a dock in Chicago. In 1936, 25-year-old Max Knoll and 19-year-old Jack Brown teamed up with an old salt from Frankfort, Michigan by the name of Captain George Waters and launched a search expedition to find the treasure ship. Cap Waters, who actually met the Westmoreland's first mate, Paul Pelkey, during the 1870s, claimed to know the exact location of the Westmoreland. The trio was said to have found the wreck and then used prototype dive gear to dive and explore the wreck site, which they described as a broken-up board pile. The following year, 1937, Jack Brown and Max Noel founded the Desco Corporation.
Desco, the diving equipment and salvage company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, went on to be one of the biggest diving equipment manufacturers in the world. The 1950s brought a couple more expeditions to find the Westmoreland. In 1954, Captain Harold E. Van Nieman of Flint, Michigan, searched for and claimed to have located the treasure shipwreck. He said the wreck covered and uncovered with the sand, and also claimed to have recovered a barrel and had it sent out to have its contents analyzed. Sadly, the following year, 1955, Van Nieman was arrested on fraud charges brought by the investors of his Westmoreland expedition. In 1957, Jim and Nancy Sawtell arrived in Frankfort, Michigan, and spent more than a decade looking for the Westmoreland. The Sawtells are best known for creating shipwreck restaurant interiors and shipwreck furniture, which was sold in the Leland and Charlevoix areas. The 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s brought around a dozen treasure hunting expeditions to northern Michigan, but no claims of finding the ship or her treasures. On July 7, 2010, while side scanning the waters near Sleeping Bear Dune, I ran over a large, ship-shaped target in nearly 200 feet of water. 3 days later, I journeyed back to the site to dive the mysterious underwater object. It was just me and my brother Bob on the boat. My plan was to dive down to the object, and if it was the Westmoreland, film the hogging arches, which would positively identify the target as the Westmoreland. We hooked the object, I suited up, and down the line I went. I looked down, and below me I saw the bow of an enormous ship. I only had a brief moment to look, then I went back to the ritual of clearing my ears, inflating my dry suit, and aiming my camera. I slowly made my way aft, surveying the wreck, and pondering if I was the first one to see this in the last 150 years. The forward cabins and pilot house were missing, and I saw the mast broken off about 6 feet above the deck. It was the same diameter as your typical telephone pole. The arches came into view. They rose about 12 feet above the deck, the passenger railing perfectly intact. There was a brace connecting the arches, a round tube about 6 inches in diameter. I reached out a hand and touched it. As I passed by, it was covered in quagga mussels. The deck appeared to be collapsed between the arches. I continued towards the stern. I wanted to see if the engine and boiler were still there, or if she was salvaged in 1874, as a newspaper report said. In the distance, the lifeboat davits appeared, the cranes used to launch the lifeboats. And there was a smokestack base, the smokestack plenum with a boiler right below it, and the engine cylinder right behind that, covered with a piece of deck, and those davits that came about 14 feet off the deck. The ship wasn't salvaged. I decided to go to the very stern, and out of the gloom appeared the auxiliary helm, a perfectly intact 4-foot ship's wheel. A single word raced through my mind: virgin. This was the Westmoreland, and she was a virgin wreck. Over the next 2 years, the Westmoreland revealed herself to us, her legend, her history, and her wreck site, an underwater museum, an ice water time capsule. The Westmoreland has been lying on the bottom of Lake Michigan, unmolested, since 1854. The auxiliary helm, not a spoke or spindle out of place. It's almost a miracle considering that Westmoreland went nearly vertical when she sank. The passenger railing still intact around most of the ship. Quagga mussels cover much of the vessel now, hiding details, but giving us the incredible visibility we have in the Great Lakes today. The lifeboat davits. Eyewitnesses say one of the davits hooked the last lifeboat launch, flipping it over, throwing 15 of its passenger and crew into the icy water. They all drowned right here on the stern of the Westmoreland. Looking down, we see the propeller and the rudder. Just the bottom blades of the four-bladed propeller touch the sand. The Westmoreland lies on a very hard bottom. Looking at the stern, we see the rudder with its unusual two attachment points. With nearly 100-foot visibility, the Westmoreland reveals herself further. From the bottom of Lake Michigan to the top of the Hogging Arch is a remarkable 30 feet. The white oak construction of the Westmoreland has proven resilient, considering she spent over 15 decades in the bottom of Lake Michigan. A gangway is wide open, her hatch being blown off during the sinking. And we see the passenger deck collapse down onto the cargo deck. Eyewitnesses said passengers and crew members were clinging to the arches as the Westmoreland went down when she sank in that December storm in 1854. Cal Coltrati, a Milwaukee artist, created this beautiful image of the Westmoreland wreck site, showing us an opportunity to penetrate the bow area. With the bulwarks missing, it's easy to enter the Westmoreland, her portside anchor hanging down, woodstock aiming towards the bottom of Lake Michigan. A heavy coating of quagga mussels obscures the Westmoreland's oak timbers. The water temperature is 39 degrees as we enter a room that has been unseen by human eyes since over a decade before President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. The windlass comes into view, covered in quagga mussels, chain still wrapped around it. Signs of the violent sinking are everywhere. Collapsed deck, pieces of wood laying all about. And there's a large cargo container, probably containing a cargo meant for the garrison at Mackinac Island. Behind that container, a staircase, still intact, rising up to the passenger deck. As we move towards the stern, we see a small opening to the yet unexplored bilge level.
Well, we visited the Westmoreland this summer. Cal and our buddy Steve Weimer from Milwaukee, and they got these images that I think are pretty good. Really show the haunting aspects of the shipwreck. Well, the discovery of the Westmoreland led me to writing this book, The Search for the Westmoreland, Lake Michigan's Treasure Shipwreck. A couple of winters ago, I ran into some problems. I snapped the ACL in my left knee, second time, same knee. I did it like 20 years ago. So remember that winter, how bad it was? Believe it or not, up north it was even worse. So this is it. So I was snowed in with two bum legs because they took parts out of this leg and put it in this leg. But that's okay. I turned my lemons to lemonade and got to work on two projects that we're going to talk about tonight. Now, I have to disclose this. These projects were worked on under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Now, not like meth or anything, but maybe some Percocet, things like that for the painkiller. So just keep that in mind as we go down a lot of different avenues tonight and talk about a lot of different things. One of the projects I got to finish up was my new book, Still Missing, Rethinking the D.B. Cooper Case and Other Mysterious Unsolved Disappearances. How many people here are familiar with the D.B. Cooper case? Wow, quite a few. Great. Well, we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. So the book's a little bit different from my normal shipwreck discovery type things, as it has to do with a missing person, this grocery store manager from Grayling, Michigan, a missing aircraft with this wonderful couple that disappeared. I had to throw a shipwreck in there. And the D.B. Cooper case. Now, everything is missing in Michigan, so let's see if we can somehow tie D.B. Cooper with Michigan later on. We'll have a little fun with that. In a roundabout way, Still Missing was actually conceived while doing ice dive training in northern Michigan. As I mentioned before, I'm a diver with the Benzie Area Public Safety Dive Team, which is part of the Northern Michigan Mutual Aid Organization, meaning if another county's dive team has a particularly difficult recovery or something, we all lend a hand and help each other out up there because it's, again, we're stretched very thin. There's not a lot of tax money for equipment and things. Well, one of the good things about this is we get to train together every few years and standardize our techniques. And one of the trainings we do is ice dive training. Now, this is from a few years back in Crystal Lake off Beulah. The water's pretty chilly, and the great thing about ice diving is if you can handle diving in water that cold in an overhead environment, you can handle about anything a shipwreck can throw at you. So if you like shipwreck diving, this is great training, though it is a little chilly. And isn't that interesting? You think underneath the ice would be smooth, but instead it's all these globes hanging down like that. So strange stuff. I think the water temperature was 34 degrees this day, so a little balmy. Well, during an ice dive training seminar in Higgins Lake in 2009, I had lunch with a fellow public safety diver by the name of Lori Tudor Smith, and also with the Sheriff Benicki from the Thumb area, who was doing the training. Over lunch, Lori shared the story of her father, Dr. Joseph Smith. In late November of 1961, Dr. Joseph Smith and his brother-in-law, John Newman, and their families were staying at the Smith's cottage located at Higgins Lake. The men went spearing about 7 p.m. on Saturday night using Dr. Smith's brand new 14-foot aluminum boat, 10-horsepower motor, and a portable generator to operate their spearing lights. They told their wives they expected to fish until about 1 a.m., and when they failed to return by 2 a.m., Mrs. Smith notified the sheriff's department, and a massive search and rescue operation was launched. The shoreline and roads near the lake were searched until 4:30 a.m., and at daybreak, authorities began searching the lake using 5 skin divers and an army duck, pictured here, and the state police aircraft and several other smaller boats. The divers worked in pairs, but were able to stay down in the cold water only 30 minutes at a time. High winds and low visibility hampered their vision, making diving difficult. The body of 42-year-old John Newman, a Dow Chemical Company lab supervisor, was discovered in about 21 feet of water. Dr. Smith was only 34 years old when he disappeared, and his remains are still resting in the bottom of Higgins Lake today. Lori Smith, who was only 10 when her father disappeared, grew up, moved away to Ohio, got married, and raised a family, but her father was never far from her mind. Later in life, she moved back to Higgins Lake. She learned to scuba dive and joined the Roscommon Sheriff Dive Team with her eye on trying to find her father. She learned to operate the Sheriff's Department side scan sonar and search for her father's aluminum boat for practice. A couple years after training with her, I called Lori and offered her to bring my boat and side scan sonar to Higgins Lake to help her search for her father. She said, "Yes, but I have to tell you, Ross, I'm very sick." And unfortunately, she was. She passed away just a few months later, and all searching for her father has ceased. But a light bulb went off in my head. I thought, what if I created a website that could tell the story of Lori's father and other unrecovered drowning victims, but also missing persons, missing aircraft. I've been involved in searching for missing aircraft, and of course, ships. There's many ships missing in the Great Lakes. I decided to call this website MichiganMysteries.com and put these stories and have them in one location where people could look at them, read the stories, and perhaps come up with a way to find these things the same way we go out and find shipwrecks. Eventually, people started contacting me with obscure missing person cases. Here's a few of those cases. The disappearance of Roger Heacock. On the evening of January 4th, 1979, 29-year-old Roger Heacock ate dinner with his wife and son, then dropped his son off at his mother-in-law's residence in Kalamazoo, Michigan. He left from there to meet an acquaintance and simply vanished. Heacock was an avid trapper and outdoorsman. The acquaintance he was to meet was a coworker and fellow trapper. He was thought to be involved in the theft of thousands of dollars worth of pellets from Heacock's garage. Later, the acquaintance agreed to meet police for questioning about the disappearance, but died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head just hours before the interview was supposed to take place. Heacock and the acquaintance worked together at the post office and had been trapping together for many years. They had trap lines in Allegan, Branch, Kalamazoo, and Van Buren counties. Heacock was never seen or heard from again. They did find his vehicle at the Kalamazoo Municipal Airport, but they think his buddy just stashed it there to make it look like he flew out of town. Interesting. I was giving this talk at a retirement community up in the Grand Traverse region, and a gentleman came up to me and he said, "You know, I used to be a teacher, and Roger Heacock was one of my students." So what a small world it is. And he said he was a really nice guy, and he is still missing. Richie Hitchcock vanishes. On December 22, 1990, at 2:30 a.m., 21-year-old Richard Hitchcock was escorted from the Riverfront Lounge, which is located in downtown Allegan, Michigan. After being involved in an incident, he supposedly was involved in another altercation in a nearby parking lot with a group of men who later claimed they witnessed Hitchcock jump a fence while fleeing them and head down to the riverbank towards the Kalamazoo River. He was never seen again. Rumors circulated over the years that Hitchcock met with foul play at the hands of those who claimed to see him last. They, however, deny this. They're still searching for him. They've had digs in the past couple years. His cousin's pretty active in trying to find him. They believe the three gentlemen that he was fighting with in the parking lot have something to do with it. On November 12, 1999, a Cessna 175 piloted by Leonard Kowalski was reported missing by a representative of the pilot's family. The personal flight was not on a flight plan. The flight departed Iron County Airport, Crystal Falls, Michigan, in the UP, and had an intended destination of Cherry Capital Airport in Traverse City, Michigan. There he would refuel and head downstate to his home. Neither Leonard Kowalski, his aircraft, nor any wreckage has ever been located. A memorial sign was placed at the Iron County Airport, but sadly it was stolen a few weeks later. Well, when we think about great American mysteries of the 20th century, what mysteries come to mind? Well, three that pop into my head are the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, of course, the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, Michigan boy, and the identity of D.B. Cooper, America's only unsolved skyjacking. Let's take a closer look at Amelia Earhart. Amelia Earhart was an American aviation pioneer and author. She was also the first female aviator to fly solo across the Atlantic Ocean. In 1937, as she neared her 40th birthday, she was ready for a monumental final challenge. She wanted to be the first woman to fly around the world. On June 1st, Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, departed from Miami and began the 29,000-mile journey. By June 29th, when they landed in Ley, New Guinea, only 7,000 miles had yet to be completed. Inaccurate maps had made navigation difficult for Noonan, and the next hop to Howland Island was by far the most challenging. Located 2,500 miles from Ley in the mid-Pacific, Howland Island is 1.5 miles long and only 0.5 miles wide. The U.S. Coast Guard cutter Itasca, their radio contact, was stationed just offshore of Howland Island. On July 2nd, the pair took off. Despite ideal weather reports, they flew into overcast skies and rain showers. As dawn neared, Earhart called the Itasca, reporting, "Cloudy weather, cloudy." In later transmissions, Earhart asked the Itasca to take bearings on her. The Itasca sent her a steady stream of transmissions, but she could not hear them. Her radio transmissions, irregular through most of the flight, were faint and interrupted with static. At 7:42 a.m., the Itasca picked up a message with Earhart saying, "We must be on you. We cannot see you. Fuel running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at 1,000 feet. The ship tried to reply, but the plane seemed not to hear. At 8:45, Earhart reported, "We are running north and south." Nothing further was heard from her. A rescue attempt was launched immediately and soon became the most expensive air and sea search in naval history up till that time, at $4 million. On July 19th, after scouring 250,000 miles of ocean, the United States government reluctantly called off the search operation. Now, just recently in the news, some researchers have found a piece of wreckage they believe is from Earhart's plane. Now, this hasn't been proven. And in 2014, they said this was found in the island of Nikimararu. Does that sound familiar? Okay. Nikimararu. It's about 350 miles southeast of Howland Island. So they say that was a patch placed on the plane, and they're trying to find better photographs to match it up for sure. So people are still looking for Amelia Earhart to this day. Easily the most famous missing person case in Michigan is Union boss Jimmy Hoffa. Hoffa disappeared in 1975 from the parking lot of the Machus Red Fox restaurant. How many people here have eaten at the Machus Red Fox? Okay, yeah, a few people there. Pretty interesting. I remember driving by it when I was in Detroit. I was in business with my uncle, and he pointed out that's where Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. On July 30th, 1975, James Riddle Hoffa, age 62, arrived at the Red Fox restaurant and parked his 1974 Pontiac at the north end of the parking lot. He had a lunch date with his friend, reputed crime boss Anthony Gaglione, and some of their associates. Hoffa had thought they were supposed to meet at 2 p.m., and when they hadn't showed up yet, Hoffa phoned his wife from a payphone at a nearby hardware store asking if anybody had called. She told him no. He then phoned Louis Lentow, a limousine company owner, and said, "Where the hell is Gaglione? He stood me up." The last time Hoffa was seen was 2:45 p.m. Then he disappeared and vanished without a trace. Authorities believe Hoffa was a victim of a mob hit and was executed the afternoon he disappeared. One thing authorities do not know is the location of Hoffa's body. The mystery would spark thousands of hours of investigation and millions of dollars worth of searches and excavations. Many rumors were circulated about the locations of Hoffa's body, including he's buried under a swimming pool in Bloomfield Hills. He's under the helipad of the Sheraton Savannah Hotel. He's on the bottom of Lake Huron. He's on the bottom of Lake Erie. He's in a toxic waste site in Jersey City. He's underneath the asphalt of the New Jersey Turnpike, a Florida swamp where his remains were dumped after they were ground up in a meat processing plant, and my favorite, a fat rendering plant where Hoffa's body was dissolved in a vat. Another source said Hoffa's body was mixed into the concrete that was used to construct New York Giants Stadium. In 2004, the television program Mythbusters went there with a ground-penetrating radar and looked all through the stadium. Their results were inconclusive, and they did not find Jimmy Hoffa. Now, Hoffa's disappearance has become iconic. Authorities have spent millions trying to find his bodies, including searches in the past year. Hoffa would be well over 100 years old right now. Jimmy Hoffa is easily the most famous missing person in Michigan, maybe even the United States. And now I'd like to introduce you to the most obscure missing person in Michigan, Robert Richard Lebsey. Robert Richard Lebsey, Richie is what his family called him. Friends called him Dick. He vanished without a trace October 29th, 1969. Dick Lebsey was born and spent his youth in Chicago. The Lebsey family had a vacation home in Grayling where they would spend their summers. Lebsey moved to Grayling for his senior year of high school. There, Dick Lebsey met Jackie Hunter, the woman he would marry. They married a year after graduating, both were only 19 years old, and they soon produced four wonderful children, three sons and a daughter. Dick Lebsey, by all accounts, was an all-American husband, father, neighbor, and co-worker. He managed the Glenn's Market in Grayling and was well-respected by his employees. October 29, 1969 was a typical fall day in northern Michigan. Dick called Jackie at lunch and told her he was going for a ride instead of having lunch with her. That's the last anybody's heard of Dick Lebsey. A few days later, his car was found in the Traverse City Cherry Capital Airport parking lot, unlocked, keys in the ignition, and half a pack of cigarettes on the dash. Now, there were never any phone calls from him, never any sightings from him, nothing. Well, 17 years went by, and his daughter Lisa and wife Jackie appeared on the Sally Jesse Raphael show to discuss the then 17-year-old disappearance. And we have that footage, so we're going to play it. And you might have to turn the volume up a little bit, Matt, if it's a little
quiet.
Please
meet Jackie and Lisa Lebsey. 17 years ago, this man walked out of their life. He was Jackie's husband and Lisa's dad. Jackie, what happened?
Well, one afternoon he just called me up and said, I'm going to go for a ride, Jackie, and that wasn't unusual. And he never came back.
Did they, he had a car? Did they find
the car? He had a company car. They found that at an airport about an hour from our home.
How long after did they find the car?
About 2 days.
Okay.
I had to wait 24 hours, you know, before I reported him missing.
Now, had he ever given you any hint or indication that he might do something like just disappear?
No.
None. When he left you, where were you? How old were you? How many children did you have? What was your life like?
Well, I was 33. I had four children from 7 to 13.
Whoa.
Yeah, hard.
I mean, and were you working?
Part-time, at our county courthouse.
Okay, when this man disappeared without any warning whatsoever, have you heard from him in 17 years?
No.
Have you had any trace or any clue or anything in 17
no.
years? No. Disappeared off the face of the earth.
Exactly.
How'd you bring up the... And you're the daughter, one of the daughters,
yeah.
Right?
My only daughter.
How old were you when this happened?
I was just turning 13, and so that was a really formative time in my life to lose somebody like that, so...
Why do you think he left?
Oh, we've talked about that, but we really don't know.
I personally think that he left because he got to the point in his life that he just couldn't handle it anymore.
Hmm. Did he leave? Interesting. The popular theory amongst his family now and a coworker are he could have been murdered that day. Who knows? His car staged there. Or maybe he did leave. It's really quite an interesting story. As a matter of fact, I've got two chapters in Still Missing dedicated to Dick Lebsey. The first chapter is entitled Robert Richard Lebsey, and the fifth chapter is called Dick Lebsey Redux, because there's some interesting things going on in his life when he disappeared. Ah. Now, the third chapter and Still Missing is entitled D.B. Cooper. D.B. Cooper rounds out our top three great American mysteries of the 20th century tonight. D.B. Cooper is an unidentified man who hijacked a Boeing 727 in the airspace between Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington on November 24, 1971. He extorted $200,000 in ransom, which would be the equivalent to about $1.2 million today, and parachuted to an uncertain fate. Despite an extensive manhunt and ongoing FBI investigation, the perpetrator has never been located or positively identified. The case remains the only unsolved air piracy in American aviation history. The suspect purchased his airline ticket using the alias Dan Cooper, but due to a news media miscommunication, he became known in popular lore as D.B. Cooper. Hundreds of leads have been pursued over the ensuing years, but no conclusive evidence has ever surfaced regarding Cooper's true identity or whereabouts. The discovery of a small cache of ransom bills by a young boy on the banks of the Columbia River in 1980 triggered renewed interest, but ultimately only deepened the mystery, and a great majority of the ransom remains uncovered. Well, the FBI investigators have stated from the beginning that Cooper probably did not survive his risky jump. The agency maintains an open case file. Well, here's where that $5,800 was found on the bank of the Columbia River. If you look, it's only 5 miles down from where they think the jet was crossed over. The thing is, they don't know exactly where the jet was or when exactly he jumped originally. They were looking up here by Lake Merwin. Of course, they didn't find anything. Recently released documents from the FBI now lead us to believe he jumped somewhere in the suburbs of Portland, which would be right around the Columbia River. Now, one thing the FBI did have were eyewitnesses. They had three young stewardesses who spent hours with him on the plane. One sat next to him for close to 5 hours, and they were able to get a composite sketch. The FBI sent their best sketch artist out. He sat down with each of them with a book, and they picked out, you know, the closest eyes, the closest nose. So he came up with this composite sketch and got them all three to agree, you know, that's probably something how the guy looks. Now, a few of the other passengers on down the line a few months later said, yeah, we kind of remember him looking a little different. And he was a little darker skinned, maybe tan or swarthy complexion, and maybe had a little more menacing look. So they came up with this, composite sketch B. So very interesting. This came out about a year later. So here they are side by side. You know, very similar, same distance, same length of the nose, chin, a little bit of nothing really stands out about the guy. Now let's have a little fun and put one of these next to a picture of Dick Lepsy. The FBI sketch is in the middle. Note the eyes here. And note the chin and mouth here. And the length of the nose, the brow. Now, I know what you're saying. You're saying, okay, that's fine. But what about the other composite sketch? Well, we can do that one too. There's Dick Lepsy against composite sketch B. So some interesting things. Both the Cooper suspect and Dick Lepsy were reported to be 6 feet tall, 180 pounds, both black hair and brown eyes. Again, the FBI does not believe Cooper survived the jump. They're looking for a missing person. By a strange twist of fate, Dick Lepsy was not reported as a missing person until 2011. So imagine that. So could it be? Next Monday, a TV station in Grand Rapids is doing a really nice piece on Dick Lepsy. So keep your eye out on Gannett affiliated stations, ABC News, or maybe even USA Today, and it'll be interesting to see. Oh, go ahead. Whoa. Well, he was an experienced parachuter because he was smart. He asked for 4 parachutes, which is a smart thing to do if you ask for a reserve chute, a back chute, and a chest pack. Well, the FBI could just you know, sabotage them, so you just jump and you can't pull. If you ask for four chutes, you might be taking a hostage with you. So they couldn't tamper with the chutes at all. So they had four different chutes for him to pick from. He picked a pretty archaic military chute to jump with, and the front chute he picked actually wasn't functional. They didn't realize till later it was a dummy chute, and he didn't even recognize the red X's stitched in it. So they don't think he had much skydiving experience. He was jumping in late November into a storm over rugged Washington mountainous area. He had no idea where he was jumping. He had no communication with the pilots. He blind jumped out. There was cloud cover, so he couldn't see the ground where he was jumping. The chute wasn't steerable. And they thought, at the very least, with this military chute, he would have broke a leg or ended up in a tree. So, you know, the interesting thing is the money being found in the river. And all parachutists agree, if he would have landed and if he would have pulled his chute to begin with, a lot of people think he didn't even pull his chute. If he would have landed in the river with all that gear on and that 40-degree water, there would have been no way he could have survived. So some people believe he did survive, but there's no proof either way. That's why it's unsolved. But just kind of an interesting thing to think about. Missing person. Well, something to ponder. On the 4th of July, a small green and white Cessna taxied down the runway and lined up for takeoff. Once in position, the pilot opened the throttle, and the little aircraft sped down the runway, lifted up, climbed, and gently banked and turned north. It disappeared into the distance. The year was 1977. The TV shows Three's Company, Eight is Enough, and the Love Boat debuted that year, along with the movie Star Wars and Smokey and the Bandit. The weather was nearly perfect that 4th of July, sunny and mostly clear. That little plane vanished and is still missing. The couple on board the plane were John and Jean Block. They were in their late 50s. John was known to be a conservative pilot and did not like to fly over water. They were flying from an airport near their home down here in Macomb County Airport to the Lost Creek Sky Ranch in Luzerne, Michigan, kind of a remote area, if you've ever been to Luzerne. So if you look at the route, okay, interesting. We have a little bit of water right there, but we know he didn't like to fly over water. He was a stunt-rated pilot, but very conservative. And he had done this trip before many times, and he would come up 75 and then turn off and land at the Lost Creek Sky Ranch. Now, interestingly enough, this spring I got a call from a fisherman who was fishing in this area in the Huron National Forest on the Osaba River, and he said, I was in a very remote part of the Huron Forest, probably a mile from the nearest two-track, and I came across a green and white part of a Cessna. Are you interested in this? I said, well, yes. Yes, I am very interested. He said, it was in a riverbank. You can see it was buried up to here. And just a little bit sticking out, and he felt it had just washed in there. So I got pretty excited about this, and I called John Block Jr. John Block is the son of John and Jean Block. He's also a friend of mine. He's a retired detective for the Grand Traverse County Sheriff's Department and lives just a few miles from me, and we get together every few months over coffee and talk about unsolved mysteries up in that area. So I called him. I said, John, I got this call from a fisherman. I explained it to him. The fisherman texted me the pictures. I texted them to John. John went to the NMC Aviation School and talked to mechanics, and they gathered around and looked at it, and they said, well, we think it might be a little bit older. We think it's from an airplane. We think this is part of a landing light. Like I said, we think it maybe is older, from the 60s. We're not sure. Interestingly enough, another green and white Cessna had disappeared in the area a few years before John's parents. So there were two missing green and white aircraft. So John felt confident enough, and he called the Alcona County Sheriff's Department, and the sheriff took his own boat up the river, because it's the only way he could get to this area, and recovered this, brought it to town, and had it positively identified. What do you think it is?
From the 60s.
It's the side of a pop-up camper. So it was pretty heartbreaking. I mean, our hearts were beating. It's like, wow. Because even the mechanic said, man, that looks like a wing. And now you look at, okay, you can see, okay, it's aluminum side of a camper. But I think there's some good news there. The good news there is somebody found something in the woods and at least did some research and called somebody. And that's what we're hoping is going to happen with this case, is a hunter or a hiker, maybe a kayaker, somebody is going to be in a remote area and find some aircraft pieces and identify somebody. Now, the thing about aircraft parts are when the FAA or NTSB does an investigation, they recover every bit of the aircraft they can, and they don't leave anything behind. So if you find something out in the woods that's from an airplane, it's not supposed to be there. Make sure to report it. And hopefully someday somebody will, and we'll be able to find John's parents. Chapter 4 is still missing is entitled The Andaste. In early September 1929, the semi-whaleback freighter Andaste loaded her hold with gravel. She then sailed past the Grand Haven pierheads out into Lake Michigan and into oblivion. 5 days later, wreckage was found off Holland, Michigan, and the next day, bodies of the crew started drifting ashore between Holland and Grand Haven, including one crew member who ended up washing up within a mile of his childhood home. Now, quietly, the Andaste has become one of the most sought-after shipwrecks in Lake Michigan, with at least three different groups interested in finding her. Now, I have some other things that interest me that I want to share with you that didn't make the book, but I find pretty fascinating. Northwest Airlines Flight 2501. Has anybody heard about this? Disappeared in Lake Michigan? Few people. Flight 2501 was a DC-4 prop liner operating its daily transcontinental service between New York City and Seattle when it disappeared on the night of June 23, 1950. The flight was carrying 55 passengers and three crew members. The loss of all 58 on board made it the deadliest commercial airliner accident in American history at the time. When the plane was flying west, as it neared Benton Harbor, the pilot radioed the tower and asked for clearance to go lower. The tower wouldn't grant. They said, stay on your present altitude. And they flew out over Lake Michigan and into a storm and vanished. A few hours later, they realized, after losing radio contact, that something was going on, and a search was started soon after. About 40 hours later, wreckage was found off South Haven, Michigan. Now, again, earlier I said I was involved with a group out of Holland before I went off on my own. It was a Michigan Shipwreck Research Association, and me and another member, Craig Rich, were really interested in this plane, and he wrote a great article that appeared in the Holland Sentinel. Well, somebody gave this article to an author by the name of Clive Cussler. So Clive Cussler called and said, hey, do you guys want to team up and try to find this airplane? So we're like, yeah, that's really cool. So he sent his crew out. We got to know these guys. So for about 10 years, Clive Cussler would send his NUMA team, including Ralph Wilbanks, who discovered the Confederate sub, the Hunley, and they would search, and we would go 20 miles off South Haven in this boat and look for the wreck. And here's some video of a trip right there. Now, we never could have afforded to look for this because it takes some really high-tech equipment, a magnetometer, which is like an underwater metal detector, to try to find the engines or the landing gear. We think the aluminum hull and wings are pretty crumpled on it, but some of those big metal pieces would be there. There's Ralph Wilbanks right there lowering the sonar fish. So they were back this summer, and a few times Clive Cussler has actually come down through Michigan quietly. No one really recognizes him. It'll stop at little towns and everything, and then he'll spend a few days in South Haven, Michigan every year. And there we are on the boat. It's really cool. Computer screens everywhere. Of course, when you have Mr. Cussler paying the bills, you can afford some of that cool equipment. That's really neat. Two-year-old Daniel Moss disappeared from a family picnic in Hesperia, Michigan on July 7th, 1963. The picnic took place at the Vita Weaver Park along the banks of the White River. His mother stated that she was tending to a minor wound on another of her children, and when she finished, she realized little Daniel was gone. Now, this is Hesperia In a minute, we're going to talk about an area, Walhalla, Michigan, a little bit to the north. Walhalla is a ghost town between Baldwin and Ludington. Anybody been to Walhalla? I knew I'd get you with one. Yeah, there's nothing there. It's a pretty sketchy place. So, a search for young Daniel begun immediately. Over 300 volunteers combed the park and nearby areas and found nothing. Police divers checked the river. And the water was described as very shallow in the river, not a lot of deep spots. Local mill ponds were drained, but all searches were in vain. 2 months later, a teacher in Hesperia stated to police that she had seen the toddler in town with a group of older children about 15 minutes after the mother noticed him missing. This was about a block and a half from the picnic area. Authorities believed the teacher's story because she was able to identify his clothing, info which authorities had not released to the public. Now, what could have happened? Kidnapping? Possibly. Could he have drowned and the police divers missed it? Absolutely. It's, body recovery is a really tough thing. Maybe he was killed accidentally by somebody on a suspended license or drinking. I mean, you never know. Could he have been carried off by an animal? Is that a possibility in the Lower Peninsula? Well, strangely, that's more plausible than you might think. The story of three-year-old Katie Flynn is embedded in the lore of northern Michigan, and the story goes that in 1868, Katie, the daughter of Henry Flynn and his wife, who kept charge of the lumber camp on the Pierre Marquette River near Walhalla, when Katie's father would drive a team of horses to a top of a hill near the camp, he would take Katie along with him and let her run or slide down the hill back to camp, which was a short distance away. On one occasion, Katie failed to return to camp, and the mother thought she was still with the father. When the father returned to camp, a search was initiated, and soon Katie's tracks were found converging on the tracks of a large animal. About then, two friends of the father, who happened to be hunters, came across and joined the search. They searched all night up and down the river and into the next day. About 4 in the afternoon, the men heard a feeble cry in the brush. They ran through the undergrowth towards the river and the voice. Just before the stream of water was reached, a huge black bear was seen to plunge into the water, swim across the river, and shuffle into the brush on the other side. Katie was found standing in a tree, which was felled and was laying across the stream. She was tenderly picked up by the men and carried to camp. Her face and hands were badly scratched. Back at camp, her mother asked her why she had not returned home when she should have. Katie responded, "A big dog came up to me, took me in his arms, and walked away with me." Noting that one of her shoes was missing, her parents asked, "Where is it?" She said, "The big dog ate it." Now, this gave rise to a local legend up in northern Michigan. I don't know if you've heard of this. Have you ever heard of the Dog Man of Michigan? Okay, up north. When we sit around the campfire, we tell the kids the story of the Dog Man. And, I mean, it's a big story up there. It's like Bigfoot, right? It's the it scares the jeebers out of them. But it's actually based in a real story. This girl was picked up and carried away with a bear and survived. So that may have happened to young Daniel. All right, back to my injury. Well, I said I had two projects, and I came up with this another kind of crazy idea. What I wanted to do is I wanted to research and then go out and search for an unfound Great Lakes shipwreck and then dive it and do it completely by myself. So I had a code, I called this project Solo, but it eventually turned into Skilligalee Shipwreck Graveyard. So I created a little bit of a video diary to kind of take you along on a little bit of the journey. One of the earliest ships to wreck on the Skilligalee Reef is the enormous sidewheel steamer A.D. Patchen. Now, I love pre-Civil War steamers. There's something really elegant about them. I knew from the story that she stranded on a reef, so 150 years of ice and wave damage is probably no longer looks like that ship. But here's the story. As many of you shipwreck hunters know, shipwreck hunting starts with research, hours and hours of research. My main source for the information of this project was one of my favorite books, Shipwrecks of the Straits of Mackinac by Chuck and Jerry Feltner. In the book, they talked about a place called Skilligalee, and there were a number of unfound shipwrecks around this reef in a very remote part of Lake Michigan. Now, Skilligalee's up there. Cross Village is the nearest town. I launched out of the Cross Village ramp, which you wouldn't believe. I wouldn't even call it a ramp. You have to basically launch your boat on the beach, so I had to be very careful and pick days where there were no weather whatsoever. The next closest places would be maybe Mackinac City or Harbor Springs up here, but very remote area up there. No recreational boating whatsoever. A few Indians fish that area, and out here is Beaver Island, which is about 20 miles past Skilligalee, so Skilligalee is probably 7 miles offshore. So there's the island. It's about a quarter of a mile long, maybe a football field wide. But what's interesting is what runs underwater right here and here, a mile and a half from shore. You can see how shallow it is. And here's a shot of it from the boat. It's clay, it's rock, marl bottom, very nasty. Comes within 3 feet of the surface. You can imagine back in the 1850s when they didn't have very good charts, that was a problem for boats. So they built this lighthouse in buildings on the island. They were torn down in 1969, and the only thing that remains is this tower. Now, this tower in Skilligalee Island just sold at auction in August for $10,000. Can you believe it? So pretty interesting. They actually put it up for auction a few years earlier, and they didn't even get one bid. But it's kind of a neat place. A friend and I talked about, man, maybe we should buy that. But I tell you, it's hard to get to, and there's no place to hide when the weather kicks up. It's a hard one to sell the wife. Well, the A.D. Patchen was an enormous wood sidewheel steamer. She was built in Trenton, Michigan in 1846. She was 226 feet long, and her loss led to the construction of the first light on Skilligalee. On September 27, 1850, the A.D. Patchen, loaded with general goods, was steaming from Chicago to Buffalo. According to the captain, the Patchen's course towards Gray's Reef Passage was disrupted by currents, which pulled her onto Skilligalee's treacherous reef. Her crew escaped and was rescued, but winds and weather thwarted many attempts to set her free. She was pounded to pieces, becoming yet another of Lake Michigan's many victims. Now, the Patchen was stranded in shallow water, so salvagers hurried to refloat the elegant vessel before the fall gales rolled in. They almost refloated her, but a storm came up and damaged the Patchen further, destroying all hopes of saving the vessel. The Patchen was stripped of everything salvagers could grab, including her upper works, china, and silverware. These items were reused on the sidewheel steamer Lady Elgin, which was built to replace the Patchen. So I spent 3 days scanning the Skilligalee Reef. And here's one of the first targets I found. I found five targets total. Seven targets. I dove five. Seven, which I believe are man-made. Five I've got to dive. This was well over 100 feet long, I could tell from the side scan. And here's some video from my dive. Again, I used two small high-definition cameras, and I toggle them around a little bit. Here's one hanging from the ladder of my boat. This wreck was in about 35 feet of water. It was found in August of 2014. As I got closer, I could see it was the bow of a ship, but it was laying on its side. Now, one of the things I do is I bring a measuring tape down and I take measurements and record them so we can try to match it up with the best vessel as possible. Now, that's the stem post right there, the very prow of the ship. Again, it's laying on an angle, but it's huge, huge white oak about this big around. The timbers are just gigantic on this thing. You can see it's covered in algae. We don't get many quagga mussels this shallow, but we get a lot of this cladophora algae, this kind of green beard that grows on everything. But sometimes we can tell if things have been buried for years, because when it uncovers, it'll be fresh wood. And if it's been exposed for many years, it'll get covered in this green, slimy stuff. So there's the bow. Now, I went around the wreck site and looked for things like artifacts. I didn't find anything. I also did the old diver's trick of reaching inside all the nooks and crannies. Sometimes maybe a piece of china or a piece of silverware will be hidden away down there. No such luck. Again, this is the hawse pipe where the anchor chain would come through. This area, the windlass was up here, and there'd be a whole other deck up here, and the chain locker below that. Again, huge white oak construction. No other wreckage around it, so I think either the rest of the wreck is close by and buried under sand, because the sand shifts quite a bit up there. Or perhaps it was carried away by the ice. There is a shelf that kind of surrounds the reef, and I can envision the ice pushing the wrecks off and them dropping off into deeper water. And some of the targets I found were deeper. I was just too chicken to dive them by myself. So with measurements taken and information taken, it's off to dive another wreck. It was actually 60s, low 60s. We still use the same dry suit. I just, underneath the dry suit, like in the winter, I'll have a snowmobile suit on underneath my dry suit. In the summer, I got shorts and a t-shirt on, and that's all I wear, throw my dry suit on. But it can get hot in the summer, and in the winter, we actually stay pretty calm. I can stay in the underwater for, 15 minutes before I start really starting to get cold. But, we got a thin-slate snowmobile suit, thick socks on, and things like that. All right, well, thank you very much for your time. I hope you enjoyed the presentation. Thank you.